One is about this picture we took. Many of you already paid for that, and you book your copy. The people that they haven't did this, please go to Jamshid and pay this €3 and book your copy. Another announcement is about the materials.
Some people arrived after Sunday, so I beg forgiveness, and they came to ask me for some material that they didn't receive, their handouts, and I really don't remember exactly who were the people. So we made some copies. If someone comes to me later on in the break and asks me what exactly they're missing, and then we can give it to them.
Thank you. Now I want call here the force of nature by the name of Bahir.
You know, dear friends, my instinct is that I wish we didn't have to hear me talking this morning, because there were things that were said by Mr. Nakhchivani in this last talk this morning that I would love to meditate on, to ponder on, and to go and do what he asked us to do, to read some of the passages that he had given us last year in the talks that he gave us on the guardianship, to read about the importance of the will and testament. In fact, I just thought, wouldn't it be better if we all just went and read the will and testament in this hour instead of having to listen to me? And there were so many other things that weighed on my mind in what he said that I wanted to meditate about, that I found myself very reluctant to come here this morning. Somebody also, in fact, two people yesterday told me that after this propelling business, they said, you know, you exhausted us. And I said to myself, well, maybe we should slow down a bit here. Maybe we should slow down, because, you know, we've got something coming up. There's something starting. You felt the vibrations, haven't you? You felt the stirrings, haven't you? It's going to come upon us. We could almost not stop Mr. Nakhchivani from taking off at the end of the talk. Well, the last 2 days of this week are going to be on that incredible subject. And I thought that with your permission, before we plunge into it with him, let's first pause. You know, these wonderful charts that he gave us show us clearly how Shoghi Effendi gave us moments of respite. And there's something about pacing, you know, something about pausing to take stock that actually helps the acceleration process. You can't keep climbing to a climax non-stop. There was somebody I knew who was a pianist who used to do a bit of self-criticism and say that when he played Chopin, he felt sometimes he was like a hippo stuck in a yawn. You know how a hippo yawns? And he'd kind of get up to his climax and then he'd get lockjaw. You know? And you need to know at what point to shut your mouth so that then you can open it again with greater force later. And I have a feeling that what we need to do today is to take stock a little bit. You know, take stock means stop and bring ourselves to account. Stop and think a little bit. Stop and wonder where we are. You know, one of the reasons I use sentences was because in a sentence, you have the sense that let me start this another way. Most of us today have forgotten how to read. Most of us have developed the art of speed reading. And when I gave you the propeller sentence yesterday, I was a little bit concerned lest you got confused between the kind of propulsion that Shoghi Effendi is giving us in his sentences and speed reading. Speed reading is superficial reading. It's a kind of reading that goes shoo over the surface of what you're reading. And you're really just trying to get a summary of the main points. And your eye goes doing over the page, turn the page, because you've got to read 200 pages before your lecture tomorrow, you know. What is this stuff? You just have to sort of absorb it in this speed reading way, which is extremely superficial. We're also being encouraged to speed read and speed think and speed listen by the media today. Everything around us in our commercial civilization, in this world of raw extreme capitalism, is telling us that words are actually only there to sell something. Words are there to give you the impression of something, usually with some kind of violent sensation that's either fear or sexual arousal or some kind of adrenaline, you know, high, so that you come away from having heard something or you thought your eye grazed the surface of something and you have the impression that you've thought. There's a great deal of difference between having the impression of thinking and actually the thinking process. And there's a great difference between speed reading and being propelled into the momentum of Shoghi Effendi's prose, which forces us to actually stop and think very deeply indeed. One of the people who told me he was exhausted from yesterday's sentence used a wonderful word. He said, "I felt drained." Now, you know, when I was listening to the drains by my ear last night as the toilet was flushing, I was thinking, is that what he meant? And then I realized, no, maybe there's a different kind of draining that he meant. But I realized that what I was hoping we would do today is not to feel drained, but to feel replenished with a strength that is coming to us from these sentences to give us the force to go towards the meat of the matter that Mr. Nachavani is giving us tomorrow. I thought of giving this sentence to you for us to ponder. I used that word with somebody a little bit earlier this week and there was an expression of surprise and I realized the person didn't know the meaning of the word ponder. How many of you don't quite know the meaning of that word? Give me a quick show of hands. Ponder. Is there enough people that don't 100% know to merit my dwelling on it a little bit? It's spelt with a P, the famous P, and it's spelt like wonder, you know. I wonder whether Mrs. Robiati's promise that the weather is going to get better is actually going to come true. I wonder whether we're going to have pasta for lunch again today. That is a different kind of wonder, okay? When you wonder a lot and you become full of that kind of wonder, then you get wonderful. Now, the word wonderful has been debased, of course. It's an example of the kind of impression of the meaning of the word which has come down to us. It's no longer full of wonder. Increase my wonderment in thee. Far from it. It's just, oh, great, gee, wonderful, which means, oh, nothing. Have you noticed how that's happened to language? How we're using words that just don't really sort of, duh, well, yeah, well, I sort of, you know how it is. I sort of like, you know, like, yeah, I don't know really like, but you know what I mean. That is the line of disintegration, friends. Let that happen to language. It's happening anyway. Don't help it. We're here to be part of another process of language, which is an integration process, a building up of meaning in our minds, a rising up to the standard set by Shoghi Effendi's immortal prose. That's the kind of language we're going to be using. Why did I say that? I've lost track. But we're going to go back to the sentence and get get some meat out of it. Sorry, where was I? Ponder, yes. Let us ponder. So the word ponder, which is spelt like wonder, only with a P, means think deeply about. It has that meaning of meditate, dwell on. It's got weight in the word. Ponder has weight in it. The word in English, ponderous, means heavy, weighty. In other words, with Shoghi Effendi, when we start reading his words, in fact, you may have had the illusion that we were hurrying, we were rushing, we were propelling, we were taking off, we were in flight, but in fact, what is happening very often in his sentence is he's pulling us with the weight of the meaning of his words down, and he's making us sink deeper and deeper into them until we go through all the geological layers of those words. So there's a simultaneous process going on there, not of integration and disintegration, but of flying and diving. It's very interesting. So we're going to ponder, we're going to weigh the meaning of this sentence. Now, you may have the impression when you look at it on the page that it's not so bad as the one yesterday, right? It's kind of shorter. It seems to be less lines on the page, less black marks. I hope you enjoy it, because tomorrow it's going to be much longer. So let's just have that nice impression that this is an easy sentence, and let's just read it together and see where it takes us. No prophet before Baha'u'llah, it can be confidently asserted, not even Muhammad, whose book clearly lays down the laws and ordinances of the Islamic dispensation, has established, authoritatively and in writing, anything comparable to the administrative order, which the authorized interpreter of Baha'u'llah's teachings has instituted. An order which, by virtue of the administrative principles which its author has formulated, the institutions he has established, and the right of interpretation with which he has invested its guardian, must and will, in a manner unparalleled in any previous religion, safeguard from schism the faith from which it has sprung. That sounds easy enough, doesn't it? It sounds like if we do a good speed reading thing, that the establishment of the world order is pretty good. Yeah. What was that all about? Oh, he said something about the world order being, the administrative order being, we get that much out of it. That's one. It's something about the administrative order. What else did you get out of that main sentence? No prophet before Baha'u'llah. No prophet before Baha'u'llah? Why couldn't he just say, none of the prophets has established anything? He could have said that. No prophet before Baha'u'llah. So he's saying something more than none of the prophets, isn't he? But we get something about prophets? Well, let's not quite figure out the prophet story yet, but it's before Baha'u'llah? We've got that much in our heads? Okay. Something or other about before Baha'u'llah, right? That's the other thing we get out of the main clause there. And the third thing we get is, has established anything comparable to. It's a bit clumsy, but basically we get that word comparable, which means comparison, make comparisons with. Nothing comparable to, okay? No prophet has established anything comparable to. So we get these three very vague, very woolly ideas when we speed read the main sentence. The main sentence is saying that all those people before Baha'u'llah did not do something comparable to the administrative order. That's vaguely what we understand. Now we look at his own syntax. Why didn't he say they did not establish anything comparable to? The prophets before Baha'u'llah did not establish anything comparable to. Why didn't he say that? He's turned it around. He's used a reverse syntax here. We don't go around saying things like that. No meal before has had so much pasta. We don't say that, do we? It's a bit awkward. No time before in Akuto has there been so much snow. We usually, when we're talking, say, there has never been so much snow before, right? We put the negative where? With the verb. Do you notice? There has not been so much snow. We have not eaten so much pasta before. But in this sentence, Shoghi Effendi is putting the negative emphasis right at the beginning of the sentence with the noun. No profit. No pasta, okay? No profit is the point there. No profit before. Now, there is a very interesting result when you put the negative in the beginning with the noun, the subject of your main clause. You put a whole different emphasis on that main clause. Where does the weight come? That's why we got the impression when we were speed reading that it had something to do with before. Because that's where it puts the emphasis. No prophet before Baha'u'llah. That's where that emphasis naturally falls as a result of Shoghi Effendi's use of the word no before the noun prophet. No prophet before Baha'u'llah. And you suddenly realize, when you begin to question why he puts the no in the beginning there, and how that has an effect on the before, you suddenly realize, oh my goodness, he's talking about the Adamic cycle. He's talking about the Adamic cycle. Do you remember that very important picture that we got right at the beginning? I had all these set up for you. Oh dear. Where is it? You know which one I'm talking about, with a circle that Mr. Nakhchivani gave us right at the beginning? I don't seem to have it. Yes, it is. It's here. Ta-ra! Do you remember that one? It's everything before Baha'u'llah. That's in the first three or four words of that main sentence. No prophet before Baha'u'llah. Doing, 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 doing. He's talking about them and that time. All in those first four words. No prophet before Baha'u'llah. Let's go to the rest of that main clause. Has established anything comparable to. Now, I remember last year when Mr. Nakhchivani was giving us the fourth of his talks of Akuto 2004, and he gave us, when you look back at the material, you see it's the contrast, he uses that word, contrast between the Baha'i administrative order and other systems of government, secular and religious. Contrast. It's to see the differences as well as the similarities. Here, Shoghi Effendi has specifically used the word comparable to. There is nothing equal to it. There is no comparison that you could make with it. And if you remember in Mr. Nakhchivani's talk last year, he spent a good two pages talking about the newness of that revelation. Go back and check the material and you'll see how much emphasis he put recalling the name of Badi, the wondrous, recreated new. This is what Shoghi Effendi is reminding us in this phrase, has established anything comparable. No prophet before Baha'u'llah has established anything comparable to the administrative order. So basically here, out of our main sentence, we've extracted these three elements that we should keep locked in our minds. One is comparison with the old orders, the Adamic cycle, the previous dispensations, the previous prophets before Baha'u'llah. In a word, I don't have it on this one, but yes I do, the prophetic era. He's saying that in the prophetic era, you could never find anything comparable to the Baha'i administrative order, the administrative order of Baha'u'llah. Now let's go back and start seeing how he sets it up and why the sentence itself is forcing us to make those comparisons. He starts off by giving us the impression we have when we first read that sentence that, oh, well, we can be confident about this sentence. We sort of feel fairly easy about what it is. I just want to tell you that this was the sentence that caused me the greatest difficulty. Just a little warning. Just while you're lingering on those words, it can be confidently asserted. Just when you're beginning to say, okay, I can be confident about this. I can even assert it. Do you know the meaning of the word assert? It was one of those words that I chose to point out to you today, if I can find it. I seem to be out of control here today. Assert. Assert means all the following and more. Affirm, which is the opposite of negate. Affirmation, negation, the two C's. Affirm, avow, allege, set down. So that it can be known. Certify. You even sign to it. You profess. It's an element of your faith. You state. You say. You say out aloud. You're not nervous about it. You're not embarrassed about asserting something. You say it out aloud. You say it loud and clear. You take it even further. You announce. Finally, you proclaim. So all of those shades of meaning are in the word assert. It can be confidently, he says, asserted. No prophet before Baha'u'llah, it can be confidently asserted. Not even Muhammad. Now that's interesting. Why does he include that? Not even Muhammad. I tell you, if this was in music, you'd hear a little drum roll there. It's a little warning that this is not going to be quite such an easy sentence as you may have thought. Not even Muhammad. Then he qualifies it. He clarifies it. Muhammad, whose book clearly lays down the laws and ordinances of the Islamic dispensation. Oh. Now let me go back again and read the beginning of that main clause. No prophet before Baha'u'llah. So all these other prophets, did they clearly, none of them, not even Muhammad, was the one who most clearly laid down something. He laid down the laws and ordinances. The others, Christ, we know he didn't himself lay anything down clearly, did he? We have his parables remembered by his disciples, written down many years later. We have the accumulated dogmas of the church centuries afterwards that have added the meanings to what he has said and done. We go back to Buddha, we go back to Zoroaster. All the way back, we realize Shoghi Effendi is telling us that of all these prophets gone before Baha'u'llah, the one who most clearly stated anything at all was Muhammad, and not even Muhammad, whose laws and ordinances were set down. Now we are ready to go on. Now, what is it that's important about those words, laws and ordinances? Mr. Nachavani already told us this in one of his previous talks, you remember. When he was talking about the line of succession, the covenant, the authorization that comes from the center of the covenant to his successor in writing, he said specifically that in the Quran, what we have had are the laws and ordinances, and precisely those are what have actually remained, relatively speaking, in pretty good shape throughout the subsequent 1,300 odd years. They're the things that have still remained. You fast how many times a day, you pray, how many times in the year, you pray how many times a day. These are the ordinances and the laws that actually, although they have had a great accumulation of jurisprudence and clogging of interpretations that have accumulated around them, nevertheless, those essential laws and ordinances have remained pretty much intact. Because the Prophet wrote them down. Now, he did not write down, as we know, as we have been taught in this Akuto course, he did not write that clear, unequivocal will that stated who should come after him. Now that begins to dawn on us as we read this sentence. No prophet before Baha'u'llah, it can be confidently asserted, not even Muhammad. Now we begin to make that comparison. It's with the laws and ordinances. Yes, he wrote those down for the Islamic dispensation, but he, even he, did not establish anything comparable to the administrative order. Now there's a most important phrase that comes tucked in there just between the verb has established and the object of the verb. Has established what? Has established the administrative order or anything comparable to, in the large sense, the administrative order. It's that phrase authoritatively and in writing. One of the reasons I didn't want to talk this morning was because I wanted to spend the whole of the rest of this hour pondering and meditating on the sublime reference that Mr. Nakhchivani gave us to, that I can't wait to get my teeth into, about the point being the individual becoming the word, which is the group, becoming the sentence, which is the assembly, becoming the whole tablet, which is the national assemblies. No, sorry, I've missed it. Going back again. Going from the point, which is the individual, to the word, which is the, to the letter, which is the group, to the word, which is the assembly, to all the sentence, which is the national assemblies, to the luminous tablet, which is the Universal House of Justice. I wanted to just keep thinking about that, because that justifies everything I have been struggling to share with you about the reading of Shoghi Effendi's sentences. Each one of us is the beginnings of those first syllables and sounds that is going to make the point on the page of existence in our own lives. How we act that out, that moment of faith, that inception, that intimation of faith in our own lives as individuals, is going to construct groups, letters. With more effort, we're going to build our assemblies and so on and so on. It just was such a powerful idea and such a thrilling piece of writing. I want to see it in front of me. I want to study it. I want to ponder it. But in this very sentence that we have, we can begin to use the same technique. Take a look at that word, those words, authoritatively and in writing. Why does Shoghi Effendi actually put it down there? In writing, he writes in writing. He writes the word in writing. That's quite something. He forces us to think about writing even as he is writing. I want you to circle the word authoritatively, because just after, when we get to the administrative order, the next clause which he gives us, which the authorized interpreter of Baha'u'llah's teachings has instituted, you say, hey, wait a minute, that rings a bell. Authoritatively, authorized, ding ding. Before I get back to that, let's just push on a little bit, because as soon as we get there, he gives us a useful comma, right? And we begin to now think a little bit more about the order. An administrative order, which, he defines it in this clause, it's that particular administrative order, in case we got it confused with any other administrative order in this dispensation, which the authorized, that's no joke actually, there could actually conceivably be people who could rear their ugly heads and start questioning and saying there could be another version of the administrative order. Bear that in mind. This is one of the reasons why we've come to Akuto, to be absolutely sure about which administrative order it is that we are defending. Let us never be confused that the administrative order that we are asking ourselves about and learning about and pondering about and discovering how to defend is that particular administrative order the one, the unique one, authorized by the interpreter of Baha'u'llah's teachings? And who was that capital I interpreter? Abdu'l-Bahá. We know that. He is the interpreter of Baha'u'llah's teachings. He has instituted that administrative order in his will and testament. But before we get into who he was, that's also part of the ambiguity and the difficulty of this sentence. Let's just push on for a minute. We've been given one clause about the administrative order. It is that particular one which the authorized interpreter of Baha'u'llah's teachings has instituted. And then, just in case we get it confused, he gives us another, much more complex clause. An order which, he's going to tell us more about it, an order which, by virtue of the administrative principles which its author, that word again, which its author has formulated. Now, there are other phrases that are going to come into that big clause. I won't push on into them just yet. I want you to circle authoritative, authorized, and author. I want us to think a little bit about those three words. In the context of this poster in front here, Shoghi Effendi, author of teaching plans. Same word. What does this author mean? What does it mean when he uses the word authorized? What does authoritative mean? Now, on the most superficial level, the word author, without a capital A, refers to a person who's written a book, at least in the English language, in the most superficial, limited sense of the word. Now, we already know that in Akuto we've gone beyond the superficial meanings of the words. We've got an author of plans. Now, of course, we also know, because we've read our chronology, that Shoghi Effendi has written a great deal about plans. They've been collected into books, his letters. We could stretch the meaning of the word back to its superficial level and say, well, he was the author of plans insofar as he wrote them up. He was writing his map just before he died. He was the author of that map. But it has a slightly larger meaning as well. It means the mind of a person has conceived of this idea. And we have to go back to the Greek myths to understand what that level of meaning in author is. You remember that wonderful image of Athena bursting out of the head of, who was it? Zeus? Wasn't that an incredible image? She was being born out of his mind. She sprang out, fully armed, from his imagination. A whole goddess standing there. It's a wonderful metaphor. It's one of the great archetypes. Remember, I told you when we read, we have to read at all the different levels. This is one of the grand archetypes of our European civilization. Now, in our Baha'i dispensation, we have this idea of authorship in the sense of the one who conceives of an idea being born out of the mind of someone. We have this in varying forms. If you go back to the sentence that we read yesterday, right at the very bottom, do you remember what that word was down there? Do you remember we got to the unfoldment of that world civilization? At the very end of that sentence, which is the offspring and primary purpose of that piece. The word offspring reminds you of Athena springing out of. Offspring. Now, the word offspring, of course, we didn't dwell on it yesterday, but the word offspring means the child of, doesn't it? It means that which is born from, conceived and born of. It's your offspring. People's offspring are their children. And it's absolutely marvelous to see in how many ways Shoghi Effendi has used that concept of offspring. We've already read them several times in the course of our Kuto material. He speaks about, as I've just mentioned, the world civilization, which is the offspring of that peace. We've already heard several times how Shoghi Effendi refers to the will and testament of Abdu'l-Bahá, which may be regarded as the offspring resulting from, now I'm going to get to that in a minute, I won't dwell on it until I go back to where that comes from, but that will and testament is also called an offspring, and the administrative order itself, which you remember from last year's work, is described as the child of the covenant, is also in a way the offspring. So we even have sort of, just for starters, three offsprings. Do you remember we had three ideas in the first main sentence? Now we have three offsprings. Do you notice that we had three words circled, authoritative, authorized, author? We're playing with threes here. He's constructing something. He didn't just happen to write this sentence in an idle moment. He constructed it carefully, consciously. And there's a subtle meaning in these different threes, in these words that he's using. The word author has a capital A. Now, at this point, I have to confess to you that I got very confused indeed. And I don't know whether any of you feel confused as you read the last part of this sentence, but I was so confused that I took my confusion to Mr. Nakhchivani and I said, excuse me, what do you think this means? Because I really was a little bit bewildered about who that author was referring to. There is a great ambiguity in that word. Just to help us get totally muddled, I will go back to the very first sentence that I gave you in this week. And if you go back to it, you'll see that there is the word author used there. Such simultaneous processes, do you remember? Of rise and fall, of integration and disintegration, of order and chaos, with their continuous and reciprocal reactions on each other, are but aspects of a greater plan. One and indivisible, whose source, capital S, is God, whose author. Now here, Shoghi Effendi has used a small a. Why? That greater plan, whose author is Baha'u'llah. Why does he use a small a for the greater plan? Now, do you remember those lines? Do you remember that chess game? Does every great manifestation of God bring us a game? They are each authors of a game which includes the major and minor plans. These greater plans, and beyond them, greater still, that we know from last year in Akudo, mysteriously, slowly and resistively, God accomplishes his design. The word design, the word game, the word plan. The authorship of one particular plan. Now let's come back to this word, author. And in order to try to understand the distinction between the word author, small a, in relation to that greater plan, and the word author with a capital A in this particular sentence, which is speaking about the administrative order, I would like to just go back and look for the context of this letter. You can see down at the bottom of the page that this comes from God Passes By. God Passes By, take a look at your chronology. God Passes By was completed in 1944. Between 1930, go back up to 1929, 1930, do you see? You've got 1929 was the Wall Street crash. The depression begins in the 30s, doesn't it? And right at that time, Shoghi Effendi begins to write those world order letters. He keeps writing them. He keeps writing them. He continues writing them all the way through to 1936. And then in the meanwhile, he's doing all those other things. Have you had a chance to read this chronology? Have you seen what he managed to do in the years during which we had a collapse of the whole world economy. We had the rising of fascism across Europe. We had the Spanish Civil War. And ultimately, the worst of the wars that we've had in Europe itself, the Second World War erupting right on our doorsteps. During this whole period, Shoghi Effendi has written not only those world order letters, but he's also, and the Baha'i worlds that he's been compiling, but he's also translated the Dawnbreakers. He has also written that immortal dispensation that Mr. Nashavani was referring to, which is part of the world order letters written in 1934. He has translated the Gleanings. He has translated Prayers and Meditations. He has written The Advent of Divine Justice, which we read that first sentence from. And he has translated the Epistle to the Son of the Wolf. And it is just after that, when the worst atrocities are being committed in Europe, when some of the greatest shames have been brought upon our collective memory on this continent, and yet at the same time, the rise of the beginning of our human rights movement, which is going to grow and grow on that dotted line until it truly becomes an understanding of the oneness of the human race. Shoghi Effendi writes, "The Promised Day has come in 1941. And after that, after three years, just 100 years after 1844, which is the Declaration of the Bab, at that time of the great first centenary, I don't count the Tablets of the Divine Plan being written on the centenary of the birth of Baha'u'llah, but I'm considering the Declaration of Baha'u'llah as that great centenary of the beginning of this revelation, in a sense, then he gives the world the promise, God passes by, from which the sentence of today has been taken. I thought it would be interesting for you to consider that God passes by was given to the Baha'i world 1 year before Hiroshima passed by. Just to think about that. I wanted to also remind you that all the statements I've put in this chronology about the writings of Shoghi Effendi, without exception, have been taken from The Priceless Pearl by Ruhia Khanum, who has described God Passes By, a book which took him 2 years to write, as the most brilliant and wondrous tale of a century, the mother of future histories, a book wherein every word counts. Think about this. Every word counts. Every sentence burgeons with thought. Burgeoning is when you've got buds like this that are getting fuller and fuller and fuller and ready to burst out. Every sentence is burgeoning with thought. Every thought leads the way to a field of its own. So now we're just taking one of those sentences. We're looking closely at each of the words that we have time for, and I've only got a quarter of an hour to finish. Oh my goodness, I haven't got to the most difficult dilemma of all in this sentence. Who is the author that is being referred to here? Who is this author? I wrote, just for the purposes of my own understanding, I wrote little numbers for the words I wanted to be sure about, that I wasn't 100% sure about. The first one was the one I already mentioned to you, the word interpreter. I put a little one there and underlined it. I said to myself, now, double check this. Who is the capital I interpreter he's referring to? I sort of had a hunch it was Abdu'l-Bahá, but I said to myself, go back and double check that. Go back and read the sentence again and again in the light of everything else that Mr. Nashavani has been saying. Be sure you understand that. The other word I marked with a number was that word author. Question mark. And the third word that I numbered was the word below, guardian. Now, why I did that was because in that phrase, that in that clause that comes, an order which, and then he describes by virtue of, which in English means by virtue of. As a result of, how can you say this? By virtue of. due to. Okay? Due to the administrative principles which its author has formulated, the institutions he, capital H, has established, and the right of interpretation which he has invested its guardian. I wrote three there as well, because there are three by virtues of. By virtue of the administrative principles, by virtue of the institutions, and by virtue of the right of interpretation. There's another three there. So whoever this author is has not only established formulated administrative principles that help us understand what this order is about. This author has also established institutions and has invested the guardian with the right of interpretation. At this point, when I was still pondering over the word author and exactly who it is, I began to realize that, oh my goodness, in one sentence, Shoghi Effendi has given us the definition of how to defend the administrative order. We were talking with one of you the other day about how Shoghi Effendi can give us the tools to defend the cause. In this sentence, he has given us in detailed ways showing the derivation from the word author, which means the one from whose mind it is conceived, to authoritative, and in writing, because it comes from the author, it is authoritative, and it is authoritative because it is in writing, not just a verbal idea. And therefore, the author who has authorized can therefore authorize the interpreter. Do you see what I'm trying to get you to do? You go from the author to what he has authoritatively done in writing to the authorized interpreter that he has appointed. There is a clear progression there, and that's what helps you understand who that interpreter is. Because Baha'u'llah, authoritatively, and in writing, in his Book of the Covenant, appointed Abdu'l-Bahá to be the authorized interpreter. That is the first clear step. Now we go to the word, the next three, the author. Now we get to that, the capital A. Because I was confused and muddled about that, and because I had read the word interpreter and I assumed it must mean Abdu'l-Bahá, although of course we also know that Shoghi Effendi was an interpreter, who was also established authoritatively and in writing in the will and testament of Abdu'l-Bahá, just in case we thought we were safe, confidently assert. But all of them have the same, both of them have the same principle. They go from the author to the authorized, authoritatively. So far, in fact, do you notice that our word interpreter, which we initially assumed to be Abdu'l-Bahá, is Abdu'l-Bahá, and beyond him, you see the shadow falling on Shoghi Effendi. It's first Abdu'l-Bahá. That eye of the interpreter is Abdu'l-Bahá. But you see that there is a continuation of that meaning invested in Shoghi Effendi. And you have to carry that understanding in your mind, because then you begin to realize that Baha'u'llah not only authorized Abdu'l-Bahá in his will and testament, in his own will, but authorized the Aqsan, the Qusn, beyond Abdu'l-Bahá. So there were more than one Qusn that was authorized by Baha'u'llah. There were two at least, and we had that Shoghi Effendi, the second one. So you could say that Shoghi Effendi was already implicitly appointed in the will of Baha'u'llah himself. You have to realize that the word reverberates beyond Abdu'l-Bahá. In this context, obviously, the primary meaning, the forceful meaning here, is interpreter, because as we have seen, the line of succession in the faith goes from Baha'u'llah to Abdu'l-Bahá to the administrative order. It's the administrative order which we are getting in the will and testament. in that administrative order, as Mr. Nachtavani was pointing out, in that will and testament, we have the possibility of a guardianship and without the guardianship, the House of Justice alone or the House of Justice with the chairman of the guardian, the living member of guardian with it. We have both there. So that line of direct succession comes straight through to the guardian. Now we begin to see that that word author that comes next could very possibly be Baha'u'llah himself. That word author, the administrative principles which its author has formulated, I first thought, well, I suppose that must mean Abdu'l-Bahá, because Abdu'l-Bahá was the author of, superficial meaning of the word, the will and testament, wasn't he? And it's in the will and testament that we get the implications of what the administrative order about. But if we look at that capital A, and then we take this sentence and we go back to God passes by, and this is really the great challenge for all of you, because I was only able to scribble it down in my own writing off ocean, because, oh, alas and woe, there is no copy of God passes by in the Akuto Library. We have to have a copy before next year. Surely, if we're going to study the writings of Shoghi Effendi, surely, if we're going to be here to read not only his plans and the authorship of his plans, but his very works, his written works, we must have a copy of God Passes By. And between now and next year, I am absolutely certain that 95 people here, whether they have God Passes By or not, will have acquired it and will have read it. And will certainly have read the context from which the sentence comes on page 326. Please put it down. I have hardly any time to give it to you, but I really must read it. And forgive me that I read it with the speed, because it's a context which needs to be meditated on deeply, because it helps us understand that word author, which it repeats. The context is as follows. The last 23 years of the first Baha'i century, I'm going to thoroughly confuse you now, the first 23 years, Shoghi Effendi says, of the first Baha'i century. Now that is, the last 23 years of the first Baha'i century. Where does that begin? 1921 until, is that right? Until 1944. So this is not something which has been noted down on this. This is yet another template of time which Shoghi Effendi has given us. He just sort of slips it in, just in case you didn't have enough confusions about how to think of time. He gives you another one. 23. The last 23 years of the first Baha'i century may thus be regarded as the initial stage, and that's clear in this chart, of the formative period of the faith. An age, and he gives it a new word now, not just formative, but an age of transition. Let's remember that. An age of transition to be identified with the rise and establishment of the administrative order. Do you see how clearly that's noted down? The rise and establishment of the administrative order upon which the institutions of the future Baha'i world commonwealth must needs be ultimately erected in the golden age that must witness the consummation of the Baha'i dispensation. The charter, famous word, which was called into being, outlines the features and sets in motion the process of this administrative order. The charter he's referring to, of course, was what Mr. Nachtavani was describing this morning as the will and testament of Abdu'l-Bahá in this context. So the charter outlines and sets in motion the processes of the administrative order is none other than the will and testament of Abdu'l-Bahá, his greatest legacy to posterity, the brightest emanation of his mind, and the mightiest instrument forged to ensure the continuity of the three ages which constitute the component parts of his father's dispensation, heroic, formative, and golden. That extraordinary charter which is going to carry us right through to the golden age. That we've already heard and pondered. Now let's carry on. The covenant of Baha'u'llah has been instituted solely through the direct operation of his, that is Baha'u'llah's, will and purpose. Full stop. The will and testament of Abdul Baha, on the other hand, the will and testament of Abdul Baha, on the other hand, may be regarded as the offspring resulting from that mystic intercourse between him who had generated the forces of a God-given faith, Baha'u'llah, between him who had generated the forces of a God-given faith and the one who had been made its sole interpreter. A mystic intercourse between him who had generated this faith and the one who has been made its sole interpreter. A mystic intercourse. The will and testament is the offspring resulting from a mystic intercourse between the mind of Baha'u'llah and that of Abdul Baha. Are you beginning to get a glimmering of something here? And was recognized as its perfect exemplar, just in case we didn't know that that interpreter there is Abdul Baha. The creative energies unleashed by the originator of the law of God in this age, Baha'u'llah, gave birth through their impact upon the mind of him who had been chosen as its unerring expounder. Now, he's already given us three words there for Abdul Baha: interpreter, exemplar, and expounder.